Free Hong Kong was one of the world's most stable, prosperous, and dynamic cities. Now we'll be just another communist-run city.
U.S. reaction to China's new security law for Hong Kong. It's Friday, July 3rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook. Check us out on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, a possible link between measles and coronavirus, lockdowns and online conspiracies, limited help for asylum seekers, tech and youth activism in presidential politics. It's all on today's VOA Asia. As China's new national security law took effect in Hong Kong Wednesday, lawmakers re-examined the U.S. relationship with China. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has the latest reaction from Capitol Hill.
The first arrests under the new security law, put into effect on the 23rd anniversary of the handover from British to Chinese rule. Under that agreement, Hong Kong was supposed to operate under a one-country, two-systems principle. U.S. officials say that is now effectively over.
Free Hong Kong was one of the world's most stable, prosperous, and dynamic cities. Now it will be just another communist-run city where its people will be subject to the party elite's whims.
The annual march marking the anniversary of the handover now has very different implications because of the new law, which the U.S. and other Western nations say curbs freedoms, including the right to assembly and free speech.
Normally, this anniversary would have occasioned peaceful demonstrations. Instead, the new law has brought scores of arrests and boasts from local authorities about how many peaceful demonstrators they've jailed. New harsh penalties for Hong Kongers for new and vague offenses. New authorities for Beijing to intervene at will.
Ambiguities in the law, which was passed in secret without the input from Hong Kong authorities, concerns U.S. lawmakers.
Is it retroactive? Do they go back to any flying of flags or making of statements? Or is it from now forward, which would be horrible enough? But that is a fear that I have.
Lawmakers also concerned suspects under the new restrictions could be forced to stand trial in mainland China.
We need to watch very carefully what happens next, particularly against groups and individuals who I'm pretty sure the Chinese government will target to make an example of in the early days after the passage of that bill.
The broad outlines of the law are already enough reason for concern, one analyst told Congress.
Extensive involvement of China's central security officials in the enforcement of this law is particularly worrying when we combine it with the broadly defined offenses.
The U.S. Senate unanimously passed a bill last week sanctioning officials, banks, and other entities who enable the new law. And more action is possible.
I think you'll see additional responses by Congress in terms of sanctions to try to convince the Chinese Communist Party that the cost is too high. They need to reconsider.
But Democratic lawmakers say that U.S. leverage over China has decreased during the Trump administration.
At the end of the day, it's the White House that sets policy. And I fear that our policy has gone astray, perhaps emboldening China.
Lawmakers say the people of Hong Kong can count on the support of America.
This is a battle between democracy and dictatorship, between liberty and tyranny, and between freedom and oppression. And it is a battle that the world must win.
Congress is moving quickly to pass a sanctions bill into law. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. China, pro-Beijing activists condemn meddling in Hong Kong. Tokyo sees biggest COVID-19 surge in 2 months. U.S. seeks Warhol and Monet paintings linked to Malaysia's 1MDB scandal. U.S. officials suspecting forced labor see shipment of Chinese hair goods. Long-shut factory helps COVID-struck Afghans breathe free. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Something data crunchers have noticed during the coronavirus pandemic, countries with recent outbreaks of measles have had fewer deaths and serious illnesses from the coronavirus. Could this be a coincidence? Or is there something about the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that protects against the worst outcomes of coronavirus? We learn more from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Last year, when measles swept through Samoa, health workers went door to door with the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. They immunized 90% of the population, both children and adults. Then the coronavirus raced through the world. But oddly, Samoa in the Pacific Ocean has been largely spared. Madagascar, Hong Kong, and South Korea also had recent measles outbreaks, vigorous vaccination campaigns, and lower rates of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. Researchers began to wonder if there was something to this vaccine, which is often called the MMR vaccine. Jeff Gold of World Organization ran the numbers.
There's a clear correlation between the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccination, and populations who have greater immunity from COVID-19.
Then Gold looked at countries with low vaccination rates for measles and found the opposite.
Italy was one of the least vaccinated with MMR in 2002, with under 80%. Then came the United Kingdom, then came France, then came the United States, and then below that, Germany.
Gold's data shows that where the MMR vaccine was given to adults, they were far less vulnerable to the coronavirus than their counterparts in other countries. A study at the University of Cambridge showed that it was the rubella portion of the MMR vaccine that seemed to confer immunity. Scientists in several countries are researching this theory. A study of Syrian child refugees at one of the camps in Turkey showed that they were six times less likely to be hospitalized with COVID-19 than Turkish citizens. Turkish researcher Dr. Ramazan Okyay says larger studies are needed.
What needs to be done is a study with people who had MMR vaccines, other than children like migrants, soldiers, travelers, and compare them to a similar adult group who didn't have MMR.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the leading infectious disease expert in the U.S., says anything people can do to improve their health and protect themselves against the disease is worth doing, especially during a pandemic.
There is the theory that if you vaccinate someone with a potent vaccine against, let's say, measles, that in fact that would give you protection that also protects you against coronavirus. That is a theory that hasn't been definitively proven.
The researchers hope their studies can prove it. If true, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine could be widely used around the world without further trials because it is safe and readily available. The hope is that it could protect us until there's a vaccine against COVID-19. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, New Zealand's coronavirus response has been among the world's best, but its health minister, David Clark, has resigned after recent controversies, including breaches of strict quarantine rules for travelers returning home and by taking his family to the beach. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, people who get most of their news from social media sites like Facebook and YouTube are much more likely to believe conspiracy theories about the coronavirus pandemic and are more likely to break lockdown rules, according to new research. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
In recent weeks, dozens of 5G mobile telecoms masts have been set on fire across Britain. Police say many of the attacks have been motivated by a false belief that 5G technology is linked to the coronavirus pandemic. Research by King's College London and polling company Ipsos Mori shows a strong correlation between belief in such conspiracy theories and a reliance on social media for news, including Facebook, YouTube, Twitter and WhatsApp, rather than broadcast or print media. Among people who believe the coronavirus does not exist at all, some 56% cited Facebook as their primary source of news.
And we found that people who had gone outside or gone to work, despite having what they knew were possible coronavirus symptoms, were much more likely to be getting their information from social media.
That presents a health risk that must be addressed, says British lawmaker Damian Collins, who also has concerns over the role social media might play in any vaccination program.
If we get to a position where we've got a vaccine, and for the vaccine to be effective, we need, you know, the vast majority of people to agree to take it, it's important that people have got confidence in that. And if people are spreading conspiracy theories and lies about the vaccine and trying to persuade people not to take it, then there's a serious public health risk to that.
Facebook, YouTube and Twitter say they have removed hundreds of thousands of videos and posts relating to COVID-19 misinformation that could lead to imminent harm. But the social media giants are facing a backlash on multiple fronts. More than 150 companies, including Starbucks and Coca-Cola, have stopped buying advertising on Facebook over concerns around misinformation and hate speech. At the same time, US President Donald Trump is seeking to strip social media companies of legal immunity for the content posted by users after Twitter tagged one of his tweets with a fact-check notice.
I think this, if Twitter were not honorable, if you're going to have a guy like this be your judge and jury, I think you shut it down as far as I'm concerned, but I'd have to go through a legal process to do that.
Social media companies say they have robust systems in place to deal with misinformation, but they remain opaque, says Allington.
Those systems have got to be opened up for auditing by democratically accountable bodies.
The evidence that social media may be amplifying falsehoods about the coronavirus pandemic will likely increase the pressure on such companies to clamp down harder on misinformation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. This news from VOA Asia, a landslide at a jade mine in northern Myanmar has killed at least 120 people as a pile of mine waste collapsed into a lake. That triggered a wave of mud and water that buried workers. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We're glad to spend some time with you on VOA Asia. In a 7-2 decision on June 25th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that non-citizens whose asylum appeals are denied by immigration officials have no constitutional right to appeal the decision in federal court. This allows the current administration to move ahead with deportations of a number of asylum seekers. Anoush Advetsian has the story, and we hear it narrated by Anna Rice.
The case is based on the matter of an asylum seeker from Sri Lanka named Vijayakumar Turasigam. He told immigration officials he had been abducted, interrogated, and beaten so badly he spent days in a hospital. He escaped Sri Lanka and eventually crossed into the U.S. from Mexico, where he asked for asylum. Immigration officials denied his request and then denied his request to appeal to a higher court. Lawyers for the Sri Lankan man appealed on his behalf, and the case made its way to the Supreme Court.
But he said, even if you're right that Congress has said in the statute that there is no, that I cannot bring this challenge through habeas, the Constitution requires that I be able to bring my claims to a federal court. And the Ninth Circuit said yes, and the Supreme Court today said no.
In denying the case, the justices pointed to a law that says that if a person is seeking asylum, he or she has a right to an interview with an immigration officer or a judge who can make a quick and final decision on their case. Turasigam says his interview lasted 13 minutes. Then the immigration judge refused his request and he was scheduled to be deported. The American Civil Liberties Union stepped in, claiming the expedited deportation limits the asylum seeker's right for a fair court hearing, guaranteed by the Constitution.
They get a very brief look by an administrative judge. Sometimes that hearing lasts 10 minutes, and that's without a court looking at the process. I think what we're looking at as the continuation of asylum seekers being sent back wrongly to persecution and possibly death.
Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito emphasized undocumented immigrants detained close to the border do not have the right to court proceedings. He added the law passed by Congress granted them preliminary consideration, and that was enough.
There's a real sense of his that he thinks that asylum seekers are abusing the credible fear process. There's a real that, you know, he, for example, he suggests that because a relatively small percentage of people who were found to have credible fear were granted asylum in 2019. And that that's somehow evidence that there are lots of fraudulent and frivolous credible fear.
Two of the Supreme Court justices voiced their disagreement. According to them, constitutional rights should not depend on the changing political climate in the U.S. Experts say this decision will create a precedent for thousands of asylum seekers coming to the U.S.
The result of this decision is that there really is no judicial oversight for this fast-track process. So it is in large part left in the hands of the immigration officers. And it's a system that is prone to abuses and mistakes because it is fast.
Deputy Solicitor General Edwin Needler, representing the Trump administration, claimed that if the Supreme Court had ruled differently, it would have created a huge judicial backlog and thousands of new cases. It also would have granted undocumented immigrants the right to appeal immigration decisions in federal court. For Anusha Vittisyan in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
This is VOA Asia. We move on now to the 2020 U.S. presidential race. In the last few months, the coronavirus pandemic has had an unprecedented complication for U.S. presidential campaigners. Both Donald Trump and Joe Biden's campaigns have had to pivot their strategies and rely on technology to raise money and connect with potential voters. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on the digital strategies used by the campaigns, how they're using it, and the kinds of information that they're gathering with the goal of winning the race for the White House.
Filled or completely empty, go reserve tickets now and leave him standing there alone on the stage. What do you say?
Call it the TikTok phenomenon.
A call to action on the social network may have contributed to lower than expected turnout at a recent Trump rally. In Nashville, six teenagers organized a march against police brutality that drew a crowd of nearly 10,000. How did they get the word out? Instagram. Today's youth are speaking up using what they know best, social media.
I think overall technology has really been a driving force for us, having those things that already connect us, and then kind of trying to figure out how we can manipulate these things, how we can use them to our advantage.
Here in New York City, Jessica Rosario and her peers have been busy rallying their community around online voter registration.
We wanted to really create a space for digital democracy.
Sharing resources and building online coalitions with other like-minded organizations are key.
There's nothing better than coming together in a group and just really talking about what's necessary and then splitting up and creating those tools so that we can share it out to our communities.
Digital activism isn't new, but young people today are making more use of it. Rosario helped create digital toolkits that supporters could use to push for legislative action in the state Senate.
People could click on it and it would automatically open up their Twitter with like a pre-written tweet that we had created. And just in a second, you could send that. It tags the elected officials, telling them exactly what the legislation name is and why we were demanding it.
For 21-year-old Rosario, who falls squarely in the Gen Z demographic, there's still an appreciation for old school technology.
Text isn't always the best. If you have a lot to say, you want to hear people's emotions when you're like telling them news. I love phone calls way better than text messages.
For these digital natives, getting everyone's attention is all about the online and offline connections. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Across the United States, many young people have spoken out on social justice issues by taking to the streets to march in protests. This generation of digital natives is, of course, very active online, capitalizing on various social media and digital tools to organize and mobilize their peers. During the pandemic, TikTok, Twitter, and Snapchat are proving to be effective in rallying the younger generation. Tina Trin reports.
Ever since the pandemic disrupted life around the world, the internet has become a lifeline for work, entertainment, and political campaigning. Tara McGowan worked for President Barack Obama's campaign in 2012 and now heads the self-described progressive nonprofit organization Acronym and the Super PAC Pacronym.
This is an entirely unprecedented situation. Without the ability to send out organizers and volunteers to the doors, campaigns have really had to get creative.
I'm not going to traffic in fear and division.
On social media, Joe Biden has been using Instagram for live conversations with social media influencers and celebrities.
Again, as president, look, my commitment to you is to lead on those issues.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome.
The Trump campaign started a daily online talk show style broadcast with a host and prominent guests, including members of Trump's family.
Joining me, as always,
join the army for Trump and download the app today.
Once on social media, there are ads, another way for campaigns to reach potential voters. The ads ask users for their email addresses, which can be gold for a digital campaign, says Jennifer Stromer Galley, who studies political campaigns and the use of digital media at Syracuse University.
Now they can start to get a profile of who you actually are, and then maybe potentially marry that to other data that they already have about that email address.
With a potential supporter's information, such as age and gender, campaigns create ads on Facebook that target a specific demographic of users. Erin Perini is the director of press communications for the Trump campaign.
We run a lot of ads on Facebook continuously. Our digital team says it's like high volume trading on the stock market. We do a bunch of them, and those that are doing well, we'll put more money behind and continue to push those. And then others that aren't, you can pull them off the platform.
To help Biden, McGowan's Political Action Committee, Pacronym, has also been advertising on non-traditional platforms.
He's the most powerful man in the world, and he always plays the victim.
We'll reach voters on streaming apps like Hulu and Roku. We'll reach voters on gaming devices like Xbox.
Both campaigns also have apps.
All access.
To engage supporters, the Trump app is gamified, where users can earn points.
Get the presidential ticket.
In 2020, when many people consume politics as entertainment,
third term.
He's doing a good interview.
Campaigns are trying to meet potential voters.
Afterwards, what do you do after this?
I think what I'll do is just sit.
Keegan, I do everything 40.
Where they are in the digital world.
2:30, Keegan.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Although our program has come to a conclusion, you can continue with us on Facebook at VOA Asia. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And you can find our full-length programs on our website. That's voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us today. We hope you come back. And we thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Popeboom. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day, a great weekend. Be safe. Be well.